Ladies and gentlemen, good day, and welcome to the roundtable and webinar on Alternative Investment Funds and Pass-Through Status, Impact of IAF Decision and Circular No. 13/2014. This roundtable is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates in association with IVCA, the Indian Private Equity and Venture Capital Association. The speakers are Nishit Desai, Founder and Managing Partner, Nishit Desai Associates; Rajesh Simhan, Head International Tax, Nishit Desai Associates; Richi Sancheti, Head Fund Formation Practice, Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Androids, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand over the session to Mr. Nishit Desai. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you very much for a little introduction. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you. It's always exciting for me to, speak with you all because more than a lawyer, I'm more of a researcher, I'm more of a lecturer, I'm more of a teacher, and I think I enjoy being a student as well. So just as all of us professionals are both teachers and students, I think the interactivity really helps us to keep our intellectual quotient alive. I think that's why it's always exciting to be having this kind of interactions. And this, as a firm, almost 40% of our time we spend on research, academics, thought leadership, and stuff like that. The simple reason is that, learning never stops. Now, in light of that, today we are going to be discussing alternative investment funds and pass-through status, impact of IAF decision, and the circular that was recently issued, 13 of 2014. I've always wondered as to why pass-through status is such a huge problem in India. I worked all over the world, whether in the US or UK or Germany or Singapore, setting up these funds and stuff like that for a large number of years. And nowhere in the world we have pass-through. It's the simplest thing. And I do not know, why this issue is so hot all the time. We are spending so much of time, money, energy on a thing which as a lawyer I feel is really unproductive. So much of time and management attention goes into this pass-through status. We are not saying we don't want to pay tax. We want to say we want to pay tax only once. And that is a simple premise on which this whole law has been based since not only the introduction of 1961 Act, but even prior to that. Law has been always clear that if you know who is the beneficiary and you know how much share should be given to him, trustee is only a representative assessee, and he only represents, okay? So he cannot be taxed. Only the person to whom income really belongs, he should be paying tax. Based on that, the law has or was drafted. It continued in 1961. And, H.E.H. Nizam's case and other ones that happened quite some time ago, they always say, so long as beneficiaries are known, so long as the shares are determinable or ascertainable, not necessarily they ascertain, but with some formula you should be able to find out. Then it simple. And so, you know, obviously, historically, trust was set up for the family reasons and for other kind of situations, creditors' trust and asset protections and stuff like that, or for generational planning. But as the world evolved, trusteeship principles began to come in when somebody took somebody's money and invested on his behalf, okay, and said, I invest on your behalf, and then I return you the money, I'll charge whatever I need to charge. That's how this whole concept of funds came in. And the fund industry actually evolved from the state of Massachusetts, and then of course it went around the other parts of the world as well. And of course my personal connection and with the, you know, firms as well, you know, the fund industry has been kind of a long association, and because I did a lot of that kind of work in '80s and stuff like that when India did not understand what the fund industry is about, what this pass-through status for the fund, how it works, or collectiveness and pool, and those expressions were unknown. You know, so when India opened up for the first time in 1991, what happened was, you know, the foreign investor began to show more interest in India. But everybody doesn't have to come where setting up a manufacturing facility or a shop. They say we want to take advantage of the markets here, or the investment can be passive, it could be portfolio, otherwise. And given our experience globally prior to that, we thought it would be a good idea to have some kind of a regime for the fund industry. Initially, there are two kinds of things, one for the public market, other one for the venture capital funds, what classically you call them. So, in 1996, you know, the Securities and Exchange Board of India issued, you know, or say they came up with what is called Venture Capital Regulations of 1996. Now, this had happened also, you know, as a part of evolution, in July 2000, you know, Chandrasekhar Committee was set up to make a recommendation to SEBI, you know, as to what kind of regime should be there, and I was part of it, actually. The report made a clear recommendation. It's 1996 and 2000 we are talking about, right? That it made a recommendation that allowed tax pass-through status to all venture capital funds. That is a starting point of any setup. And so that the profits of VCF are tax-exempt, or not exactly exempt, but not taxed at the pooling vehicle level, but they should be only taxed in the hands of the investors. That has been consistent position. It will be walking into 2016, maybe year after next, right? So 96, 2006, and so 20 years, we are still talking the same thing, right? And in May 2012, the AIF regulations came in, and SEBI enacted all these so-called alternate investment funds regulations and completely overhauled the system. But in that, only certain types of funds were talked about as like a pass-through thing. Again, it does not mean that what is given by income tax is taken away, per se. And so this pass-through has remained a puzzle which should not be there. In fact, we can facilitate that, you know. And income tax law is also very clear that, as I mentioned, that if the trustees know whom the investment belongs ultimately, or to whom what you call the income has to be distributed, or the assets are to be distributed, it should be only the person who is called so-called beneficiary. beneficiary, or otherwise called contributory, is the person to be taxed. Now, there are two sets of provisions of the income tax law, and both of them are applicable to achieve a pass-through status. One is, as you know, the revocable trust provision 61-63 and all those kind of things, under which fundamental principle is that if there is any property that is transferred by one person to other person with a right to revoke the transfer, okay, then any income arising to the transferee will be deemed to be the income, or it will be considered to be the income of the transferor. Say I give you a book, or I give you some money, and say anytime I can take it back from you because I'm going to some dangerous area, or in old English days, in like the 12th century and 13th century, people used to go on a war. So what used to happen, they say, okay, here is my land, here is my property. I go on a war, I don't know what would happen. And when I come back, then you give back my property. During that time, whatever way you want to deal with the property, you deal with. You want to rent to somebody, you want to lease somebody, you want to grow some crops, anything that is there, I give you. So trustee is the legal owner of the property, but I can take back. Okay. So that's how the whole trust concept came in, realistic. Then, of course, then the variations improved. And as we go along, so the law actually provides that when there is something called revocable transfer, the income will be considered to be that of a transferor for tax purposes, although legal title may remain in the transferee. The concept was little expanded to say that revocability does not only mean revocation by the transferor. So they said if the transferor in the transfer deed, what you call trust deed or other kind of transfer deed, has any provision whereby directly or indirectly there is a provision so that the assets or the income of the transferred property will go back to the transferor, that would be deemed to be revocable trust. So I can set up, say, an irrevocable trust. So for legal purposes, let us just for a moment, when you talk revocable, in the context of a trust, it means revocation by the settlor or the transferor. Power to dissolve with the trustee is not necessarily revocable for legal purposes. Okay. So revoke, when you say, it is in the context of the discretionary trust. When you say discretion is with whom? With a trustee. Okay, it's a simple concept. So in the process, when the transfer is made and there is any provision in the transfer deed or trust whereby there is a direct or indirect way in which the property can go back to the transferor, it will be deemed to be revocable. The settler may not have direct power to, you know, return the money, but the provision makes it so. So say in case of IIF, you must have seen, there is a trust deed, then there is a manager, okay, investor. He has got certain powers, and there is a placement memorandum in which also 75% of the beneficiaries or otherwise together, they say, okay, it should be resolved. So it is also construed as revocable, even though directly one beneficiary may not be able to revoke the trust. So in that case also, so it is considered revocable. If it is revocable, then it has to be taxed only in the hands of the beneficiaries, okay? And so, you know, if you look at this decision, it just reiterates this principle that if there is a revocable trust, it should be normally taxed in the hands of the transferor. In case of Section 161 to 164, which I'm not going into too many details, but there the provision is if there is a trust, for example, and if the beneficiaries are known or identifiable, and the shares are specific or say ascertainable, then again that should be taxed only in the hands of the beneficiary. But there is a provision, I believe under 163, to say that tax department has a right to tax the trustee as well, but once the trustee is taxed, you cannot tax the beneficiary, only to protect the revenue. But this provision doesn't exist in the context of section 61 to 63. It is only vis-a-vis chapter 6, I think, 16, right? So where you can have that situation, but if it's revocable, there is no option but to tax only the beneficiary. And these are both the provisions that are applicable in most of the venture capital funds. So the principles are clear. It's very simple. What was already well established, in fact, we had worked on AIG Trust, which all of you know that is called XYZ, you know, private equity, the decision of 1996 only, I think, right? Yeah, I was myself involved in that. But so principle has been clear for a long period of time, mid-90s, okay? Same decision has also been followed in this particular decision, okay? Now, in between, department issued the circular. It was sought to clarify the position, and it confused you, you know, because what had happened in 1980, there was a provision brought in the trust law to say that if the, you know, if on the date of the trust the beneficiaries are not known or their shares are not specified and so on and so on, that caused a little confusion. And then department issued, no, if it is not so, because later on you can add beneficiaries, then, you know, we are all going to tax at the trust level, you know, which was a bizarre, I would say. Because actually what they should have done, they should have interpreted the section more in favor of the taxpayer, so there is a clarity. And they have a power under Section 119, right, the circular system. So they can expand the scope. Even if there is confusion, they could have clarified. Even though the law to us, as counselors and lawyers, is very clear that there is no confusion, but, you know, they interpret it negatively. And this is what is causing some issue. And this particular decision has, unfortunately, made a little statement to say that the circular cannot have a retrospective effect. It will have it does not even say that it will have a prospective effect. Okay. So one question that arises is whether, what is the, you know, sanctity of this particular circular? So even though we have clarity on the law, what is the implication of this circular? And I think I'd want to keep it suspense for a moment, but maybe would you like to say a little bit, Richie Sancheti, my colleague, leads a funds practice. So why don't you say a few words?
So I think I'll just pick up the tab from where Mr. Bhai started off. Like, when you are setting up a fund, how do you go about it and the pass-through issues, etc. So I think the broad idea is that if you are setting up a fund, irrespective which jurisdiction you set up, what is the asset class you're looking at, what is the investment thesis, the first two questions you ask a fund counsel or when you are devising the structure is A, which jurisdiction, and B, which entity. Now, jurisdiction is very critical, as we all know. You sometimes, if you are tapping offshore investors, you rely on treaty, etc. But when you are setting up a fund in India, the jurisdiction is very clear. The jurisdiction is India. Then the second question which comes up is which entity. Now, this, the choice of entities, you know, you can sort of take into account when you are setting up a fund in India. You're not spoiled for choice. The reason you're not spoiled for choice is you're limited to either a company, an LLP, or a trust. Now, the reason why you would choose a particular entity is either on two folds. A, the law which governs that entity, and B, tax aspects. Now, law which governs that entity is very critical because if, let's say, you were to set up the fund in a company format, how you are defining the rights of the different investors, what are the redemption terms, etc., rules of the company for certain reasons. Now, if you look at tax-specific issues, there are two issues which are very critical for any fund to sort of confirm. A, there should be tax neutrality, and B, there should be tax certainty. When I say neutrality, it means that if the investor had directly invested in that asset class, the tax impact on him vis-a-vis him coming through the fund structure to invest into that asset class should not be different. It could either be better or at least it should be neutral. So if a structure does not allow you a pass-through treatment, pretty much you are defeating the first, you know, thumb rule that it should be tax neutral. The second aspect is tax certainty. So what happens is if the investor is putting his money into the fund is investing, and at the time of upstreaming cash flows, when the asset has been redeemed or there's an exit, you get a cash flow for the fund and the fund in turn makes a distribution to the investor. There should be certainty. So if a fund is a 5-year, 6-year or a 10-year product, you should know at any point in time what would be the taxation at each level of these cash flow that you're talking about. Now again, unfortunately, because of certain various reasons, again, a tax structure for a trust sort of a format worked till some point in time. Like Nishitbhai indicated, over the past few years, right from 2007, when you know a change was made that a pass-through will only be allowed if a trust were to invest in only 9, 10 identified sectors. Then there was an amendment in 2012 where they said, okay, we will not look at the sector, but we will give you a clean pass-through. It was a very temporary change because in 2013, there was another set of amendments to reflect the new AIF regulations being introduced. Now, along with the Venture Capital Fund regulations of 96, you also had funds which are under subcategory 1 as a venture capital fund. They were also recognized for pass-through. Unfortunately, it sort of overruled the use of pass-through for other category 1 AIFs or category 2 or category 3, which is in the context of which we are having our discussions today on whether a fund which cannot rely on provisions of tax section 1023 FB, how will it maintain the tax neutrality that I was talking about earlier, A. B, given the recent ruling in the case of India Advantage Fund, are there any lessons or learnings that we can sort of take into account when we are doing our drafting of fund documents? Or are there any sort of background material that we should keep handy when we are defending the pass-through structure? So I think before we start the analysis of the actual facts of the case, I would also want to sort of indicate that we have acted as fund counsel. So accordingly, whatever analysis we share with you today in this forum would be limited to what is already there in the order itself. So I think to give you a little background, the entire fund, India Advantage Fund, was set up in 2006. ICICI Venture was a settler, instructed WITCO, which is currently IDBI, as the trustee. The trustee, under the management agreement, again recognized ICICI Venture as the fund manager. The fund manager, the trustee, along with each of the individual contributors, entered into a contribution agreement. This is very critical because, as my colleague Rajesh will also deal separately, a case was also made out that, okay, if are all the contributors coming in together, is there a cohesiveness between the contributors sufficient enough to say that there was a joint purpose, and hence the entire structure be tagged as an association of persons. Here, as in if you go through the, you know, the ruling in detail, the counsel for the SSE as well as the, you know, the ITAT also upheld that because each of the contributors had a different contribution agreement to rely on, and as opposed to an offshore fund structure where you have a shareholders agreement or a LPA agreement where all the LPs are counterparties, because each of the contribution agreements is vis-a-vis that particular contributor, it sort of rules out there being an AOP. And there are other reasons also which Rajesh should add to it. The second limb to it is, just like any other fund structure, you would have a lot of no default provisions. Like where if you were to terminate a trust, what are the different grounds in which you can terminate a structure or a fund? Critically, class A would be, okay, if there's a key person provision, let's say the manager who raised the fund, on whose strength you raise the commitment, is no longer associated with the platform. That could be a ground enough to suspend the commitment period. I'm sure we are all aware in the different fund terms. But apart from that, there could be other non-default provisions also. Like let's say if 75% of the contributors or two-third majority of the LPs were to, you know, say that, okay, take a call that, okay, we are no longer happy with how the fund is progressing. There may not have been a key person provision, but we still want the trust to be no longer in place or let the assets be distributed or liquidated. These are the sort of provisions which were also there in this particular case, India Advantage Fund. There was a Article 13 in the trust deed allowing the trustee to sort of wind up the structure and give a distribution of the assets upon liquidation. This becomes critical when Rajesh will discuss the revocability provision, because if the trust deed under which the entire trust is created itself has a power for the trustee to revoke the structure, it could be a case of direct revocation of the trust. In support of that, what also happened, as you may also be familiar with the industry practice, a lot of the terms of the trust deed gets incorporated in the PPM, the Private Placement Memorandum, where you allow the investors to recognize the fact that they can, together in a consensus basis, revoke the fund. Now, this was perceived in this ruling to be a delegated form of revoking the trust. Basically, the trustee had delegated the power, certain powers to the investment manager under the management agreement, and the management agreement allowed the manager to insert certain clauses in the PPM, which was issued by the manager, and this allowed a different mode of revocation as well. So there is a case of both direct revocation as well as delegated case of revocation. The second piece, which is more relevant for the case in hand, is how they went about, you know, their representations before the tax authority. To begin with, they filed a return. The income return pretty much stated the income of the fund. It also sort of stated what was the TDS already paid on behalf of the fund, and hence they wanted a refund of the TDS. A revised return was filed, which this time, however, only stated the total income of the fund, did not claim for the refund. And the justification that was given, again it's appearing in the body of the order itself, is that the TDS is an entitlement for the individual beneficiaries or the contributors who have already paid taxes in their own individual PAN numbers, etc. And accordingly, they are the ones who will be taking a credit of the TDS paid. On the part of the fund, what they have done is they have prepared an allocation letter indicating to each of the beneficiaries what is the allocation of income plus what is the allocation of the TDS that they can take a credit of. Now, this is where the tax department came back, said that, okay, we A, argue whether you are determinate or not. B, we argue or claim that you may not be revocable. You may be irrevocable, because we believe to revoke is a power that you should inherit, etc. Again, certain arguments that we'll have some more analysis back and forth. And so the third piece was that you are an association of persons. It is not possible for, you know, so many contributors on an individual basis to track the investment. Clearly, there is some amount of joint enterprise between all the investors. That joint enterprise is not sufficient to be deemed a partnership under technical language of the law, but it is still sufficient enough for you to be an association of persons. And to begin with, that element of profit has been taken away from the definition of AOP. Earlier, you needed a joint coercion combined with a profit motive to be there. But as long as you are coming together, that's also sufficient now to be an AOP. The last piece was that the tax department said that you are not determinate. Again, this argument was made by the tax department by saying that, okay, today you have the ability to add on more contributors. B, you don't even know what new contributors coming, what, how much money they'll be putting into the fund. And C, I don't see a particular number or a percentage there in the trust deed, which can allow you to substantiate the claim that you know how much each contributor is entitled to. So this, there were a lot of defenses made. A, the most critical part was, reliance was made to previous rulings, which again Rajesh will add towards, that as long as my beneficiaries are identifiable as a class or there's a definition given, and B, the share of their income from the income of the fund is ascertainable, stress is again to the words identifiable and ascertainable, then it should be sufficient for me as a fund to make a claim that I am determinant. And the way they went about it is, in the order which again ITAT also upheld, was that as long as you recognize contributors as those people who have entered into a contribution agreement with the fund, that is a good enough class to recognize the contributors distinctively. And as long as you have a formula which does not allow the trustee to retain any discretion as to who gets how much out of the distributions of the fund, that is also sufficient to be deemed as the income being ascertainable. So with these two limbs satisfied, ITAT found in favor of the SSE. The appeal made by the tax department against the order of CIT appeals was not upheld. So basically, the CIT appeals order was continued. And on that basis, you know, we suddenly find ourselves with new jurisprudence of, is there an alternative over and above the determinate issues which we continue to face all the time. In addition to the CBDT circular, which has added more flavor to how you demonstrate your determinant or not, can we now also take an argument of revocability? Can we now make a claim that, okay, the contribution made by the investor was on a revocable basis, and hence there is another level of pass-through which is now entitled to the fund? I think it's a broader summary, but that is too long.
Yeah, I think what is critical here is, I think at least for the last 10 to 12 years, we've all been sort of working around as to whether the revocable trust argument is something that's going to hold good when it comes to the court. Because from 96 onwards, once you had the AIG decision, people were relying on the AIG decision to sort of say that, well, we have to determine the nature of the trust, because the beneficiaries are identifiable and the shares are ascertainable, because we sort of put in a class of beneficiaries, and at any point in time, you can actually pinpoint as to who the beneficiaries are and what is their pro rata allocation as far as the distribution are concerned. So we've always been relying on the AIG decision, at least for the last 18 years or so now. To go under the path that, even if I don't have the benefits under 1023 FP, it doesn't matter. I can still go under the on the basis that it's a determinate trust, and therefore there is only one layer of tax. And it's not a situation where the trust is going to be taxed at MMR or the maximum marginal rate. The revocable trust argument is pretty interesting, because I think one of the key issues that a lot of people were grappling with was the fact that a revocable trust as a rule was always an anti-avoidance provision or an anti-abuse provision. And here we have a situation where, as a taxpayer, I'm taking a positive view to say that I want to apply these anti-abuse provisions in my favor, to say that the original contribution by the contributor itself was a revocable transfer, and therefore there should not be the transfer itself should be disregarded, and any income as such should only be taxed in the hands of the contributor. The tribunal hasn't really gone into the aspect as to what is the nature of 61 to 63. What they have really looked at is to see what is the scope of 61 and what is the scope of 63 in order to determine whether or not the contribution is a revocable contribution. And I think there are two key elements here. And interestingly, what the tribunal has first said is that they've looked at the terms of the trustee and said, well, what does the trustee provide for? The trustee provides that the trust is going to be there for 7 years. There can be multiple extensions which can be undertaken in certain circumstances. The trustee can terminate the trust, or there can be an early termination, provided 3/4 of the contributors agree, and you get the permission from the investment manager. So here you had a situation where the power of revocation was not necessarily with the contributor. It was the trustee who was actually who had the ability to revoke. What the court said was that for the purposes of 61, which effectively provides that if the transferor makes a revocable transfer, in that case, I'm not going to recognize it. There is no requirement that it is the transferor who has to revoke the contribution. As long as somebody has the right to revoke, that would suffice. And even if there are certain contingencies that are attached, that is fine. It is the power that matters. If the power is vested with the trustee, that would also suffice for it to be treated as a revocable contribution for the purposes of 61, Section 61. This is a slightly different way apart from a revocable transfer under 63, because 63 is more of a deeming fiction to say that under certain circumstances, we will deem that certain kinds of transfer will be treated as a revocable transfer. What 63 provides for is that if the transferor has the power to reassume the assets which have been transferred, or has the power to enjoy any income that is arising out of the transferred assets, then we are going to deem that the transfer itself is a revocable transfer. In the situation that you had here was that apart from the trustee, you had the PPM. The PPM also contained similar terms. The fact that under the PPM, the contributors, 3/4 of them, could come together and actually revoke the contribution, or essentially terminate the fund as such. And the investment manager had to go along with it. What the tribunal essentially went into was the fact that here it is not only a situation where there's in the trustee has the power to revoke, but you also have to look at the other ancillary documents. The ancillary document in this case is the PPM. The PPM provides for that power being vested with the contributor, and the investment manager has to act in accordance with the instruction. Therefore, it is a situation where the contributor has the power effectively under certain circumstances, which is 3/4 of the contributors getting together, to come and terminate the fund at any point in time. So this was the second reason that was used for the tribunal to essentially say that even under Section 63, since the contributors themselves also have the right, it will also be treated as a revocable transfer under Section 63. So you have two layers of argument which has been accepted by the tribunal as to why the transfer ought to be a revocable transfer. The one aspect which really the tribunal didn't go into in much detail is as to whether the power to reassume the power to reassume the assets, whether that would mean that there is a capacity issue in terms of whether the contributor has to get it back in the capacity as a settler or as a beneficiary. That's not really gone into in much detail. But I think the tribunal has been very clear that so long as that particular ability is there for the contributor to get back the assets, even subject to whatever contingencies that are there, that is sufficient for them to determine that it's a revocable trust. The key difference between going down the path of a revocable trust versus going down the path of a determinate trust, especially in the fund context, is this. If you went under the path of a determinate trust, that still gave the ability for the tax authorities to pass the assessment either in the hands of the trustee or in the hands of the beneficiary. So you always had this issue where there is some degree of mismatch that was always there, where the tax authority sometimes went after the trustee, sometimes they went after the beneficiary. You got side letter agreements in place and all as to how to sort of manage those kind of situations. But once you go under 61 to 63, there is no discretion that is any longer vested with the tax authorities. The tax authorities can only go after the beneficiaries or the contributor in this case and tax the contributor, and at no point in time can they really go after the trustee. And that is a key difference between going down the path of a revocable trust versus going down the path of a determinate trust, which is what I think in a lot of instances people were going under. The other issue is that as far as the determinate trust is concerned, I think what the tribunal was very clear is that we completely agree with whatever was set out in the AIG decision. They went into the historical context, the fact that in 1980, when the amendment was made, there was a particular rationale that was provided, essentially because at that point in time, people were trying to go, people were flipping around from time to time between a discretionary trust and a determinate trust to sort of go under the ceiling for taxability. So there was the explanation to 164 was inserted in 1980 with a particular reason. And what the court said was that, listen, as long as you have the ability to pinpoint at any given point in time as to who is the beneficiary, what is their shares, it doesn't matter even if it's a complicated apportion mechanism. That is not the court's concern. As long as that is there, it will be regarded as a determinate trust. This will be the case even if at a future point in time, new contributors are being added from time to time. Because that's what happens, right? You have multiple closings in any fund context. And one of the challenges, especially when we come back to the circular, is how will you sort of manage multiple closings, because let's say at first closing you have one set of beneficiaries, at second closing you're going to have additional beneficiaries being added. Because of that, the pro rata, the allocations will change. What the tribunal said was that, well, it doesn't matter. Even though there are new contributors who are coming in, that still doesn't change the fact that I can still identify as to who the beneficiaries are. The beneficiaries are the ones who have contributed. And I still know that I can determine what is the allocation, because there is still a formula that is there in place as to how the new contributors, what will be the allocation that they will be getting. As far as the court was concerned, they said that is good enough. And that is something which AIG had also seen, and we agree with that particular position.
So I think, so on all the three grounds, on the question of it being a revocable transfer under 61, the question of it being a deemed revocable transfer under 63A, and also on the position relating to determinate trust, on all the three counts, the tribunal essentially said that, well, we agree that this is a revocable transfer and we agree that this is also a determinate trust. And therefore, to that extent, the pass-through benefit should come through. The last aspect which I think Richie was mentioning about the association of persons, I think this was a much easier task, because I think there have been enough situations that for any entity to be considered as an association of persons, the key requirement is people have to come together with a common purpose or common objective. In case of any fund, that requirement of the people coming together itself is not there, because when I as a contributor, I don't care who else is coming in. I may be interested in ensuring the anchor investor comes in, but that's different. But there is no commonality in terms of everyone coming together at any point in time. Maybe a pooling vehicle, but I still don't need that test. So therefore, the tribunal to that extent said that, well, we don't think it's a AOP. The last, and this is, I think, the most critical aspect, is how do you look at the circular number, the CBDT circular, and what the ruling really said, and how do you sort of, what's the way forward? As far as the circular is concerned, and this was something that was brought up by the tax authorities, saying that, well, circular number 13 of 2014 very clearly lays down that the beneficiaries actually have to be named in the trust deed, and that never happened. In any, today in the fund context, if you look at it, it's very difficult for you to do, especially when you're looking at multiple closings and all, that when I actually execute the instrument, the names of the beneficiaries are there. What I think, what we had done in AIG, this fund and all of it, is the beneficiaries are those who are effectively contributed, or the class, there's a particular identified class of people. For example, institutional investors or HNIs who contribute and sign up to the contribution agreement, they are going to be the beneficiaries. That's usually the way your standard terms are set out in the in your trust deed. What circular number 13 of 2014 actually said was, well, we want you to actually name the beneficiary as on the date, and that's something that's next to impossible, will never happen. Even as far as the shares are concerned, it keeps changing. If you have multiple closings, your shares are going to keep changing. What the tribunal said was, well, when they looked at the circular, they said, well, the circular has no application as far as this particular instance is concerned, because for the assessment year in question, the circular was not there in place. If at all it has any impact, it's only on a going forward basis. But having said that, you have to step back and say, okay, what is really the role of a circular today? A circular is there, and I think there have been enough decisions around what is the nature of the circular to effectively say that as far as the circular is concerned, a circular cannot change the provisions of law. If the circular is to the benefit of a SEC, to that extent, even if it is against the clear position in law, the SEC can still rely upon the circular. So those are the two fundamental propositions which have been there. You have a constitution bench judgment which says that the SEC can rely on the circular if it's favorable to him, even if it's against the law. You have enough other decisions of the Supreme Court which says that circular cannot make law. That is not the job of a circular. Circular's job is to clear up if there are any ambiguities involved. You have at least two decisions now. You have a tribunal decision, which has essentially said, well, what we think the law is that you only need to have an identified class of beneficiaries, and you just need to ensure that there's a formula in place to determine the allocation. That we believe is enough as far as determining the nature of the trust, and to say that it's a determinate trust. Similarly, you have an advanced ruling also, which is the AIG decision, which also effectively says the same thing. The tribunal has also relied upon other decisions of the High Court, mostly of the Madras High Court and a couple of other High Courts, which have also held similar views, though not in the context of a fund, but in case of a regular trust, to say that there is no requirement in law today for me to name them. Because you can always have a situation where, let's say, even in a regular trust, to say that, well, my wife and kids will get pro rata allocation. Well, what if one more kid comes into play? So the allocations will change. Court has said that, well, that is fine. That's still determining because you know that at a particular given point in time, how many, if there are four people, it will be, okay, it will be the wife and three kids and 25% allocation, that's fine. So the courts have always been fine with it. So even though now you have a circular that is there in place, the circular today cannot necessarily override the law. So therefore, even as far as 161 to 164 is concerned, in terms of a determinate nature of a trust, as a SSC, you still have the ability to say that I don't care what circular number 13 of 2014 says. I can still rely on the tribunal judgment. I can still rely on the AIG judgment to say it is a determinate. The second, and I think more importantly, the easier argument for me is that, well, it no longer matters whether it's a determinate trust or not. Because I'm just going to take the argument that it's a revocable trust. Circular number 13 of 2014 only deals with whether a trust is a determinate trust or not. It does not deal with a revocable trust. As a SSC, I have the option of going under 61 to 63 to say it's a revocable trust, completely ignore circular number 13 of 2014 and go in on the premise that since it's a revocable trust, there is only going to be one layer of tax which ought to be in the hands of the beneficiary or the contributor. So I think that's the flexibility that you sort of have at this point in time, at least looking at this ruling. I think the other key point, and which you can probably add to it, is that you now have a situation where there are funds of various vintages. You have funds which have been set up in 2006, 2007, you have funds set up in 2011, now you have funds which are getting set up post 2000, post the circular, and Rishi, you can probably add on how it's going to work on each one of them.
Sure. No, I think just to add to that, if you look at 1023 FB, which is first your clear-cut safeguard provision saying that, okay, if you are a venture capital fund under the old regulations of 96, then we'll give you a clean pass-through. If you're a venture capital fund in the category one, then also a pass-through is entitled to you. So perhaps the discussion under the circular, or even as far as the, you know, the ITAT order is concerned, it becomes slightly mute because the law itself recognizes a pass-through status for you. The other provision is for a venture capital fund, let's say, which is, you know, raising a fund after 2012, or as you may be aware, even though the AIF regulations came into place in 2012, lot of SEBI registrations were granted as late as March or April 2012. So those are the funds which will be, you know, sort of raising commitment, etc. right now. Lot of live examples, funds which are in the market in raise mode right now, who are raising now, which is post the CBD circular. Clearly, even their defense ought to be that, okay, we are covered under 1023 FB, and hence this circular should not apply. But leaves it open, because the argument was used by the tax department. It was used in the context of a venture capital fund where 1023 clearly applied, and the fact can also not be ignored that the tribunal did not say that, okay, this does not apply on a venture capital fund. Tribunal only observed that the CBDT circular cannot act retrospectively. It cannot act on assessment years which are previous to the year of the circular. That's about it. It did not give a view on this. But really, we believe if you are a venture capital fund, you have a very good case that the circular has no application on to you. In fact, the circular itself...
Under Category 1 only, right?
No, when I say venture capital fund, I would mean under the old laws.
Okay.
The VCF regulation. Okay. Because I think, just to refresh again, this entire order was in context of a venture capital fund only, not in context of an AIF.
Yeah.
In fact, that is where the whole point comes up. Is this circular at all relevant? When the circular itself, on the face of it, the first paragraph itself says that if you are a fund not covered under 1023 FB, then in those cases, if you are a non-charitable trust, this is what we believe the law should be, or it's a view on that. The next piece is, like Rajesh said, funds which are vintages after 2012, if you are an AIF, and if you are not covered in a 2023 FB, you are an infra fund or SME fund, etc., or if you are a Category 2 fund, or more interestingly, if you are a Category 3 AIF, which has a slightly more active strategy, where the view has been so far that, okay, is this business income? And if any part of the income of the entire fund is business income, is this subject to tax at maximum margin rate under 161(1)(a) or 164(1), etc. Then it becomes interesting that, okay, even though if I'm not determinate, even though if my income is of the nature of business income, do I look at the set of sections 161 to 164, or can I still make an argument that, okay, this entire investment was on a revocable basis? That, frankly, as far as a Cat 3 AIF is concerned, principally we would believe that the strategy would be very liquid. You are investing on a NAV-based product. You enter today. You perhaps can have an exit structure after 3 to 4 months, depending on how the NAV is doing and your notice period, etc. There could be a situation where, let's say, an investor comes in the month of July, exits in the month of December or January. He entered after the financial year started, exits before the financial year ends. For those sort of structures, etc., can they then make an argument that, okay, this was a revocable sort of a contribution, and hence I should be able to, you know, treat this as business income, and if I have business losses, then I should be allowed to set off, etc. So then it becomes slightly more interesting.
And I think that the last point to my mind will always be on the unified structures, because at least that's one more headache even for unified structures that you have, that you go back and try and look at the treaty benefits because it's a revocable transfer. You have the ability then to potentially just completely rerun the treaty benefits as far as any streams of income are concerned. So I think that's another good thing that comes in.
But
so,
of course, just to qualify that, foreign investments into AIFs, as you may be aware, it's still not that portrait. View in the market is that, okay, if you're a category 1 venture capital fund, then because the old laws were replaced by the new law, again, it's not a view subscribed by all the custodians, then as a foreign venture capital investor, FECI, you can invest in an DCF. But having said that, I don't think there are any publicly accessible approvals so far from FIPB, allowing direct participation into category 2 or category 3 AIFs. I believe formulation of the, you know, the entire strategy around foreign investments into, you know, unique AIFs which can leverage 2x at least on the NAV, that I think the government is still to come to terms. So foreign investments right now not possible.
I think there's been a great deal of discussion around the whole thing, and we'll go into question answers very soon. A large number of people are on the call because of webinar. Okay. I wonder, you know, this kind of circulars, are they really doing damage to the whole country? Today, everybody understands that new government, there are lots of expectations. Everybody thinks that this government will do something. But when I meet international investors, their question is not that what they will do, how fast. The question is how fast. You know, that is where we had large conference done in New York at the HPRA. Thought about 68 all the funds and others will come. About 148 people turned up, you know, all GP, LPs and others, which was a great surprise. So from small room, we had to go to the big room. But almost everyone had the same question, that would reforms happen is not a question. Question, how fast? Now, if we have this kind of tax circulars coming in the way, look at how much pain people have gone through to develop multiple trusts. Every time a new investor comes in, okay, you have to do another closing, so next trust, the third trust. Is this the way we want to do? I think this is not a good governance, I would say, honestly. And number two, that our laws have become so complicated. If I want to explain what is capital gains regime in your country, I think it will take half a day. What is short term? What is long term? For which asset? For which not asset? Where for FI it is long term, whether it is business income, whether it is capital gain. You know, this whole maze of capital gains taxation has been made so bizarre. It's so difficult to explain, you know. And that is what is deterring lots of investors. I think we need to have, now, at least in light of the fact for the last 20 years, consistently, the judgments have been coming in to say this kind of situation should be passed through. My request would be to modify this circular instantaneously, immediately, and say, okay, you want to bring money into the country, here is a simple regime. So long as you can find who the beneficiary is, how much income should be allocated to him, or the distribution should be, it should be simple pass-through. No doubt about it. And nowhere in the world I have found so much of problem on pass-through as I started off. So I think this is first thing we really need to know. I hope people listen to us. But the whole idea of, we had meeting with SEBI and the tax department, the whole idea was to explain that we need a pass-through. And what came up was this circular to say, no, there will be no pass-through. So what was clear was it was not clarificatory circular with respect. It became ambiguity certificate, ambiguity kind of circular. I think this is not the way to do that. And it's not in the interest of the tax department, nor in the interest of India, nor in the interest of foreign investors. I think we need to really nail, because who are going to make investment in the fastest possible manner? The private equity people, the funds. If you want to have a so-called Make in India greenfield project, it's going to, they say we'll put $2 million, but over a period of 5 years, 10 years, right? So announcements are big, the numbers come in immediately are small. But these people bring immediate investment. I think this is what we need to realize. It bumps up market, it reverses confidence. We are all talking about those kind of things. And I hope things would change rapidly. I think with these words, I would, for the time being, close my words, but open up to the questions. If any of you have, but can we give a little opportunity to the people who are on the call at this point in time? If it is a difficult question, I think Rajesh or Richie will deal with the simple question I'll take.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on your touchtone telephone. Participants are requested to use only handsets while asking a question. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one at this time. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. The first question is from the line of Path Jain from Tata Capital. Please go ahead.
Welcome.
Mr. Jain, your line has been unmuted. Please go ahead.
Hi. My question is whether a clawback provision in a contribution agreement would affect the determinate structure of a trust.
So I think I'll take that one. I think we first will have to first understand what do we mean by determinant. Now, if you look at the tax act and again the guidance thrown in by this ruling, it's very clear to be determinant. There are two limbs. One, your investors should be identifiable and that their share of the income should be determinable or ascertainable. Now, as long as these two limbs are not being affected by clawback and the clawback mechanisms are very clearly provided, that the clawback will be pro rata your distributions or prorata your capital contributions to the fund. As long as the formulas are pretty much there, I don't think there is a discretion needed on the part of the trustee on what the clawback amount should be. I think the entire analysis is geared towards the fact that as long as the trustee or nobody else has a discretion and there are formulas to sort of ascertain what the numbers would be, the structure should be perceived to be determinate, or there could be a defendable argument that this entire arrangement is determinate. So I don't see clawback posing a new challenge in this analysis.
So basically everything should be pro rata and nothing should be, so there should be no discretion at the end of the trustee basically. That's what it boils down to.
So it's not even pro rata. You should be able to get the distribution waterfall having the proper formula for that.
Okay.
I think pro rata is what we generally talk about, but there is no requirement of pro rata.
Correct.
So, but the idea at all points in time, you have the ability to sort of figure out as to what is the distribution waterfall. That's really what you're looking at, and the identity of the people as to who are really getting it.
Okay.
See, another thing that I would always suggest while fund is being formed, see, most of the time we focus on structure, right? Everybody knows this, how the structure is. The structuring is only one part. But when it comes to looking at the tax or other legal issues, is the articulation of structure into fund documentation. So language and the way in which you write your words, that matters a lot more today. Because when you go to tax department, they don't look at the structure chart. They look at every line of the PPM, they look at every word of the trust document, every word of the contribution agreement. So it is very important that it is not just the like clawback or anything else that we take in, but how you write that particular document, what do you include in that, what words, in what context to use it, that becomes, that is where the real art really lies, you know, because regulators don't look at your structure chart. They only have a framework to understand, but really speaking, neither the courts particularly, would be more, refined on looking at every comma and full point.
Thank you very much.
Most welcome.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Nitesh Agarwal from IBOF Investment Management. Please go ahead.
Can we structure the AIF as a pass-through vehicle, given these, especially the Bangalore ITAT assessment?
So I think his question was, can we structure the AIF as a pass-through vehicle?
It's a fully
pass-through. Attempt would be in that direction, I'm sure. Whether you achieve it or whether the tax department.
Whether we get it through revocability or whether we get it through a determinate trust, either one works. But I think the whole point of discussion was that you have, I think, one more avenue that's been created to get the pass-through status through structuring it as a revocable contribution. And at least I think that's what the whole context of the IAF decision has been.
In fact, other interesting thing that you might want to consider while drafting or developing an agreement or documentation is also to take care of whether it is in relation to investment or it is a business activity, because still that issue has not really taken prominence except in some cases I had argued in relation to foreign institutional investors. That what is the nature of the income, particularly if it's a hedge fund like or other ones. Then you have another issue that you need to very carefully articulate whether it is, if it is not a capital gain, if it is a business income, then again two things will come up, whether under 161-164 kind of thing, whether you are carrying on business. If you are carrying on business, then they will say, no, this is trust itself is taxable at the rate, maximum marginal rate, right? But once again, one can always look at section 61-63, the revocable argument. So fortunately, there are two sets of provisions in the tax laws, and one can play around with both of them. But one needs to be very careful in how you articulate. And that, for example, whether you use the word investment activity, business of investment, or investment activity, trustees shall carry on the business. So when you write those words, you know, then you get into this kind of a trickier situation, you know, and always devilize in
detail. Right. Just to add, though it may be of some interest to you, but until 2003-04, the language under 1023FB was any income of a venture capital fund. That subsequently got revised to say any income from investment, by investment of a venture capital fund. And this got tested before a court of law also, where they said, okay, if you are temporarily parking your funds in a mutual fund or a liquid product before, let's say, making a distribution or before you deploy, etc., that temporary investment clause that you have, would that partake the nature of business income? And because part of your income is business income, can we then, we shed the entire income by saying that, okay, because part was business income, the entire thing is MMR. So all those issues have also been taken
In fact, out. I remember, because that's part of the evolution of the whole regime that is coming up. Look at mutual funds. They constantly buy and sell, right? But what happens? They are granted tax exemption anyway, irrespective, so long as they distribute 90% or 95% or whatever that amount, so long as they continue to comply with those regulations, you don't have a problem. Okay. So when venture capital regulations were developed, we say, you say any income of a venture capital fund should get kind of a pass-through. Not necessarily only capital gains or only business income. And then again they change the language. So when somebody keeps on tweaking around with this, tinkering with this language, so then they say it should be investment income. So those small things have become little, you know, bit points, and one needs to take care of those ones as well.
Any other questions?
Yes, so we got a next question, which is from the line of Arnav Chaudhary from Union KBC Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah, we want to check under the AIF structure category 2, this real estate fund category would also fall under the same premise of if the trust is being able to determine that it's a determinant as well as a revocable trust, the Bangalore ruling falls in favor.
So I think real estate as an asset class is no longer a recognized category, or rather there was a proposal under the draft AIF regulations that came before the final version of the law that real estate funds also be recognized under category 2. Since that is no longer the case, you are either looking at equity or a debt fund subcategory under the category 2. And both of them individually will have to sort of satisfy the requirement of either being determinant or, thanks to the ruling, revocable to that extent for a pass-through treatment.
So to that extent, I think, especially when you look at real estate funds, right, most of the investments today are a mix of debt and some degree of equity, but substantial debt. So usually the risk which has always been there for real estate funds is whether they will be treated as business activities, and in taking the stance of even on the determinate trust, whether the risk of it being classified as a determinate trust was usually a bit more higher when it came to real estate funds. I think the comfort which this ruling gives you is the fact that because the revocable trust argument has sort of opened up, that gives you the ability to potentially say that, well, I can go under 61 to 63. So it doesn't even matter if for any reason the tax authorities decide to treat it as a determinate trust but a business trust, and try and tax it at the trust level at MMR. You still have the ability to go under 61 to 63. That is what I think the comfort that the ruling gives you.
Okay, thank you.
We have someone here from the audience, so maybe because they are...
Can we just take one more question if there any, and then...
Okay, we'll take one more question. I know a lot of people may be there, but here are also a lot of people waiting to ask questions. So, okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. The next question is from the line of Ravi Saraogi from Institute for Financial Management and Research. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Ravi from IFMR Investment. So my question basically relates to the July CBDT circular that has caused so much of heartburn. So my question pertains to, are we really sure of this interpretation that the circular mandates that the trustee should have the name of the beneficiary at the date of creation of the trust? Because what it appears is that, you know, the first three paragraphs of the CBDT circular, that mentions the date of creation of the trust while explaining the problem. But paragraph 4 onwards, you know, when the CBDT clarifies, you know, there it just says that a situation where the trust deed, you know, does not name the investor, then it is, you know, indeterminate trust, and, you know, it will be taxed at MMR. But in that explanation section of the circular, it doesn't say explicitly that, you know, if the in the date of creation, if the investor's name is not there, then it's a problem. So are we really sure of this interpretation that, you know, on the date of creation of the trust deed, the names have to be there?
So just to give you a backdrop to the circular, right, because before that there have been multiple meetings that have been happening between, I know that IBCA has been meeting, we've had various representations, I know various drafts of the circular which has also been floating around even prior to the introduction. So the whole idea behind the circular was supposedly that, well, we want to clarify this for once and for all. The problem that came up was the language which they adopted. In the ideal situation, what we would have wanted the circular to do was just to take the language from the AIG decision and just put it in. That would have solved the problem once and for all. While in some respects I can understand that the intent of the circular was really to sort of, you know, clarify it completely. The problem is that once you have a language which has built up the ambiguity, the fact of the matter is that there is a degree of ambiguity that the circular has created.
and you're relying upon different tax officers in across multiple cities looking at the circular and trying to make an assessment based on that, that's where you'd have ended up with a nightmare, because you're going to have a tax officer who may not necessarily understand the ins and outs of how a fund works, coming in and saying, looking at the circular, saying that, well, it's not named, therefore I'm not giving the benefit. So that's where you would have ended up at. And I think from that perspective, when you think about it, at least now you have the decision which is sort of says that, well, this is what we think as far as 161 to 164 is concerned. So therefore, I still have the ability to go under that and say that I don't even want to go into the circular to see what it says or what it does not say. But yeah, to a certain extent, as I said, the intent behind the introduction of the circular was a positive intent. Unfortunately, I think it didn't come out in words.
Thanks.
Yeah, we have a question here, so you could measure this.
After the final closing is done and before distribution happens, this is a default by one of the investors and you decide to reduce the size of the fund. Does this really impact everything? Because your percentage of determination goes for a toss from the day you're closing and day you are distributing it.
See, this is always happening. For example, you say that, okay, I put this money in trust for my grandchild or for child, and he will get it at the age of majority, right? Something happens to him, okay? Does it become discretionary? No. So there are always different conditions that are put in the trust, because many times, you know, for domestic reasons or for other reasons, you have number of conditions provided and number of different situations that are visualized in a trust deed. Most of the time, what we are talking about, a very simple trust deed speaking, compared to what I would have seen in a large families and other ones. But because you provided some conditionality, doesn't take away its character as a determinate trust. So long as you are able to identify at any given time whom the monies have to be given. That would be the broad, you know, context.
A change in allocation is not what you're concerned. It's about that, can I say, let's say today, I can pinpoint as to who is getting it, how much is getting it. Let's say there's been a reduction. At that point in time, can I still pinpoint who and how? That's really what matters. And the fact that obviously you want to take out the discretion to the extent that is possible. I think there's a couple more questions that are still on the call. The moderator, Margaret, can you just... Are there any other questions on the call?
Yes, sir. We've got one participant waiting. The next question is from the line of Ujas Popat from Piramal Enterprises. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
With respect to the revocable argument in case of a trust, can we make the trust deed legally revocable like we have in case of a securitization trust? And if this is feasible, then how would SEBI react to it?
I think even in the current case, it was a venture capital fund, and pretty much, you know, the tax department did approve that, okay, they viewed the entire arrangement as revocable vis-a-vis the contributor. Mm-hmm. And frankly, revocability is a, you know, issue more for the tax department as opposed to SEBI. SEBI has not come back to my recollection ever in the past that, okay, is the trustee revocable or not. There are certain features that SEBI insists being incorporated in the trustee, especially with the new AIF regulations when they're very clear on what different documents should contain. Even the scrutiny by the SEBI department, etc., has increased now. Mm. But to my recollection, the revocability is a tax issue meant more for the tax department vis-a-vis SEBI.
If I may just add one thing here.
Yeah.
Whether investment managers will like revocability. Because, you know, if I invest and I say I want to revoke, you give me back my money. Mm. So to structure that way, revocable trust, customized to each investor, would become, to that extent, a nightmare. Mm. So possibly that will not help you. But of course, depending on your, take, technically you can do it. But I think we do not like it because, you know, you want to say the irrevocable for a certain number of years, you cannot do anything. If you do not perform in some 5-7 years, then of course you can do it or extend it a little bit, but at the end of the day, only at that. Because then you can take a complete view of, you know, the risk that you are taking. Because you may take some high risk now thinking that after 2 years I'll have another investment or third investment. So here you become completely vulnerable. So that's the only reason we have to, on the face of it, I would say, better to make it irrevocable, okay, for legal purposes, but revocable for tax purposes.
Correct.
That's the art.
Yeah, and I don't think SEBI will have an issue.
Okay.
Because, as I said, I think it's the investment manager who has a much bigger problem to deal with the moment it becomes revocable.
I had another small question, if time permits, then can I ask?
Who's speaking?
This is Ujjas here.
Oh, yes, sir.
Can I go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. See, with the CBDT circular, plus with also the writ and invit regulations coming out and some tax clarity with respect to those regulations, you know, somewhere as an industry, we feel that, you know, like government is a bit going away from a pass-through kind of a concept and they are more ramping on tax at a trust level. So, you know, like while your interaction with the government people, is this what you also sense that they are moving away from pass-through, or in near future or in next budget, they would like to even clarify that there is a pass-through for all, including writ and invits?
So I think firstly, the whole concept of the REIT and invits and how you view VCF, whether you sort of try and put all of them on par with each other, I don't think that has been the intent of the government. The discussions that we've had with the regulators, when it came to the REIT or the invits regulation, and where we were having similar discussions on pass-through, and that was a much longer discussion than probably what we've had for private equity. I think their concern was slightly different. Their concern was around the fact that, well, just because the developer has developed, we don't want them not being taxed at all. We are still wanting to get some degree of pass-through and all. So I don't think it's necessarily something that you would have to equate the situation as far as REIT is concerned with the whole private equity industry. I think I don't think the government has ever come in or even indicated to us that they don't want to give pass-through. But they are looking at things as different asset classes with different structures, and we have to look at them not necessarily in the same way. So will you see the government trying to move away from a pass-through? At least we have not seen the signs, obviously, and even you probably would have had much more interaction than me.
One thing is that we do not know why government does something at a particular point of time. You know, there is significant amount of distrust, okay? And I think what can be simple and still be implemented, you know, we somewhere along the line detour. No, we are all thinking in terms of our Indian context. The difficulty arises more in the case of international context. So if you have an entity in India and the entity is subjected to tax, for example, would I get a tax credit in my home country? This is single biggest issue in the world today is double taxation. You know, I would not go into great detail, but biggest issue is that if I do not get full tax credit, you know, in my home country, then I have clear disincentive to come to India. So my way of looking would be, let us look at our laws in harmony with the foreign countries, particularly those from where we are expecting investment. At one point of time, you know, we used to have most of the laws that are aligned to English law, correct? Which is still basis, and it is good basis. Now, majority of the investments are coming from the US, okay? If you look at ESOP and other things, so what is happening is that if our laws are not in harmony, I would not say identical, but not in harmony, we have disconnect. And the disconnected situation creates a lot of regulatory issues, cross-border, You try to comply with the regulation of one country and you violate the other one. And on the top of it, the tax laws, if they are not harmonized a bit, then there is double taxation of the same income, which is a clear disincentive. So we really need to understand, okay, there are, which are the geographies from where we are getting maximum, investment? It's US, okay, to some extent some other countries, maybe UK and Singapore or whatever other ones. If you look at most of the 70-80% would come from this jurisdiction. At least let us harmonize our laws in line with those countries. Look at LLP, just to give you an example, right? The LLPs which are in existence in the US for a long time, mostly used for professional firms. Now, in the UK and in Singapore, they are considered a separate body corporate, okay? Now, in India, when we brought, we took the concept, in fact, I made representations also on that, but we changed certain things, so we are not in harmony. Now it's a new law. Why people are reluctant to use LLPs today, except if you are very close-knit people? Because the law is new, you do not know how it will be interpreted, how disputes will be resolved. If your original general partnership law, Partnership Act of 32, whatever, that is more understood by people than the new law, and you cannot apply the precedence or the wisdom that is generated in the UK, for example, case laws or in Delaware, or you can't use those cases because you change the language, you change the schematics. For what reason? So I think what we should be doing, we should have as much imitation is best form of appreciation, of course, but you call something called benchmarking, you're going to benchmarking afterwards. So we should be taking some of the rules, how they are done elsewhere, then it will be seamless, you know. And nobody is saying we don't want to pay tax. But the problem is that if there is double taxation, then it causes a problem. So that's my answer to, you know, this partial pass-through that thing has come up now in case of this rates and invites and whatnot. That should be understood. But once something has come in, it's so difficult to change, and that takes away time, you know. So I think let's hope things will be better.
Okay, thank you.
Some question is here, yes, in the audience.
I just wanted you to throw some light on the applicability of this Bangalore tribunal judgment on the double taxation issues that are specifically to Category 3, 2 or Category 3 AIF. Is it as applicable to Category 2 and Category 3 as it is to venture capital funds?
You're talking about the pass-through? See, if you look at AIG decision, what had happened? The entity, AIG entity in Mauritius, had invested in the Indian trust. And our claim was that it's a pass-through. So Mauritius entity, which invested even through domestic vehicle, should be entitled to bilateral treaty benefits. Okay? And the court said, yes, it is possible. And it should be allowed. That is a Mauritius company investing in Indian trust, Indian trust investing in portfolio companies, exiting from India, going to Indian trust, money is going back, there is no tax.
So even if you use the revocable trust argument, right, the analysis is sort of similar, right? You're saying that, well, it's a Mauritian entity which has sort of invested into the portfolio company directly, because I'm effectively completely disregarding the Indian trust that's been set up. So therefore, any income which is coming through from the portfolio company, I'll be taxed based on the treaty and between Mauritius or wherever the fund is actually located and the portfolio company, completely disregarding the Indian fund that's been effectively set up.
And hence the pass-through argument is identically applicable to...
Yeah.
Irrespective of the fact
it is, in the US, they use word what you say, it's called disregarded entity, as if it doesn't exist.
Because it's...
Then it's a seamless.
To add to that, it would be the nature of income would be business income in the hands of the AIF.
Depends.
See, it depends on the argument that you're using, right? And that's where it becomes critical. As to, if you're going under the 164 argument, the determinate trust, and it's a business trust, what the law really provides for is that there is a tax in the hands of the trust at maximum marginal rate. That's where I get a bit of an issue when it comes to, let's say, a Cat 3 potentially. of CAT 2, whether or not the treaty benefits will apply, because then you're effectively, your domestic law is saying that it's the Indian entity, the trust which is being set up, which is going to be taxed. When I use the revocable trust argument, that sort of falls off. The concern which I have sort of falls off to a certain extent, because what I'm saying there is that it is as if the Indian entity never existed, or the Indian trust never existed. So it is always as if the Mauritian entity or wherever the fund is located invested directly into the underlying asset. And the stream of income that's coming through, you'll be taxed under the respective DTA, so I think that's where a slight difference actually there. So at least from a CAT 2 or CAT 3, subject of course to the government deciding which way to go as far as investments in a unified structure.
But this is a very interesting subject. Some point in time we can sit longer. But if there is a business income, assume for a moment, right? But it is revocable. It will be still business income in the hands of the investor.
Right.
In absence of permanent establishment, I'll say I have no taxation.
And what if the
investor... That's what's in Fidelity's case, I had argued.
And if the investor was the Indian investor, it will be taxed in the hands of the Indian investor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why the revocability is very interesting subject to deal with. And there is no question of taxing in the hands of trustees. There is no one equivalent of 163.
So in the light of this, basically that 28 July circular is effectively null and void.
To a certain
extent. Yeah, except for lawyers.
Except for lawyers and trust me, you're going to have some degree of some tax officer who's going to apply the circular saying that, well, I don't think the tribunal decision will apply to you because, well, the tribunal is a Bangalore tribunal. You're sitting in Bombay. I'm not going to apply that. I'm going to go by the circular.
And more critically,
those kind of situations will arise.
And more critically for the trustees also, right? Because right now, they're only limited trustees. It's one of the most monopolized businesses. So what the view trustee takes, you go by that.
I have two questions. When I'm sorry, I came in slightly late. You mentioned that you have a view that there is a beneficial provision in the law versus what the July circular is, and you, as a taxpayer, would choose to take umbrage into the beneficial provision of
entitled
the
law.
Entitled
to take.
So, yeah.
So I think, let me reword that. If there is a circular which is more beneficial to me than what the actual provision of law is, I can take advantage of the circular.
Correct.
If the circular runs contrary,
so I'm
what
trying to understand what provision is what that you were referring to.
Yeah, so what 161 today, the way the courts have interpreted it is that you only need to have the ability to identify who the beneficiaries are and the shares. You don't need to necessarily name them in the trustees. What the circular says is that you need to name them in the trustees. So I'm going to go in and say, well, look, section 161, along when you look at all these case laws, does not require me to name the beneficiary. So I'm going to rely only on the provision of law along with the judgment and not rely on the circular, which I think is not as beneficial to me.
Is the CBDT circular, I'm not sure, does it say or and when it says names as well as the beneficial interest?
It's both.
It's both. So how does that sit with, say, the AIF regulations where SEBI says if there is a material change in your memorandum, an investor can exit? The beneficial interest in that
at any
case.
Point in time, right? So the question is that at each point in time, I can tell you as to who the beneficiaries
okay.
are and what the shares are.
Based on a whatever predetermined
form. That's fine. That's good enough.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you don't mind, I think there's a lot of interest, but we can end this session with a big thank you to each one of you for coming here physically and also those of who you are on phone, that also must be a torture because sitting virtually somewhere and listening to a boring group of lawyers, I'm sure, you know, it's not easy. So, but I really thank you so much and welcome again. We have other interesting stuff coming up, but we'll let you know. And if any one of you missed or friends, otherwise, I think our mobile application you download, you can see the same things. You don't have to worry about wasting your working time, and it will also go on our and also go on Nishit.tv. Maybe both of that technologies will hopefully help you. But excitement is, of course, in coming together. So those who are virtually present, please come here physically, even if you're abroad, and be with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your line.